The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin. Winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Much to discuss in our rumbling world, from North Korea to Eastern Turkey and beyond today. But right in our own neighborhood, we also have a crisis, an American city that seems to be the victim of basically a chemical attack on their water. The attackers weren't terrorists, saboteurs, or industrial polluters. It was their own city water system poisoning them. Melissa May's home is at ground zero of this contamination in the city of Flint, Michigan.
At the end of the day, every time they have an ache or a pain or another blood test or something else that is going wrong with my kids, and they ask me why this happened, the answer is always because the government wanted to save money. These people who don't know us made decisions for us and wouldn't go back and change them in enough time to save anybody.
Water quality scientist Mark Edwards says the attackers responsible for this chemical waste are familiar. Government omission, cut corners on safety, and then a cover-up.
It was the injustice of it all in the very agencies that are paid to protect these residents from lead in water knew or should have known after June, at the very, very latest of this year, that federal law was not being followed in Flint and these children and residents were not being protected. And the extent to which they went to cover this up exposes a new level of arrogance and uncaring that I have never encountered.
The water crisis in Flint, Michigan has been developing all of last year. Residents noticed a change in the water almost immediately after the city shifted to a different water source. With its aging lead and iron pipe plumbing, the city did not do enough to make sure the heavy metals would stay on those old pipes, and the effect of the new water was to corrode the pipes and send the contaminants directly into people's homes. A program of reassurance, boiling notices, city-installed filters didn't help. No one described this as a crisis until it was obvious. Now, the state head of the Department of Environmental Quality, Dan Wyant, and his spokesperson have resigned. The mayor of Flint during the water changeover is out, and now residents are pretty much on bottled water. Michigan Governor Snyder issued an apology to Flint in a written statement last week. "I want the Flint community to know how very sorry I am that this has happened, and I want all Michigan citizens to know that we will learn from this experience because Flint is not the only city that has an aging infrastructure." Governor Snyder did not return our request for comment. Mark Edwards, you just heard from, is a nationally renowned expert on municipal water quality. He and his team in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech formed a task force to address the problems with Flint city water. And you also heard the voice of Melissa Mays, a Flint resident, parent, and founder of the activist group Water You Fighting For. Mark, welcome to you.
Hello.
And Melissa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Melissa, did the state of Michigan essentially allow you or the city of Flint leave you to drink toxic waste?
Oh, 100%. They encouraged it, actually.
Encouraged you to drink what was essentially, by chemical standards, toxic waste?
Yes.
How did you come to understand that?
I never did. We never accepted it. They would sit here and tell us that even if it's discolored, run your tap for a while, it'll be fine. It's safe. Just let your water run for a couple of minutes. No big deal. It'll be fine. This is just a bump in the road. Just a plethora of excuses and lies, and just told us, drink your water, make sure you pay your really high bill, and drink that water. It's safe. It's fine. We're telling you it's safe.
What kind of questions did your children ask you?
Why does the water smell funny? Why is the water yellow? They would come running out of the bathroom screaming because the bath would be yellow or blue. And they're like, Mom, something's wrong with the water again. And then as they started to get sick, they just couldn't understand why they didn't feel good. And the fact that the whole time it was the water is terrifying. And now my kids won't drink water. They won't do anything unless it comes from a bottle and they see where it comes from.
Mark Edwards, what was it that the city of Flint did that created this problem with Melissa's water and so many other residents?
90% of the problems arose from one fact and one fact only, and that is they did not follow federal law and add a corrosion control chemical to the water.
And this would have been required because they were shifting from one source to another. And when you do that, you have to understand that the pipes are going to respond differently to a different source of water.
Yes, it's very dangerous to supply water in a city that has 50% roughly lead pipes without a plan to keep the lead on the pipes and out of the water. It's also a financially good decision because in general, for each dollar spent to control corrosion, this is the most expensive problem faced by water companies around the country. The water will eat the pipes up and you will lose about $10. And in Flint's case, because it's a uniquely large system and it's already very old, probably for every dollar that they save by not putting the chemical in the water to control corrosion, they're going to lose about $1,000. So not only is it unsafe and illegal, but it's financially irresponsible too.
Melissa, what did you say to officials at the city level and all the way up to the State Department of Environmental Quality, you and your colleagues, trying to convince them that this was a serious problem?
We brought them more and more research. As the year went on, we connected with Bob Bocock, Aaron Brockovich, Lois Gibbs. So we had all of these experts bringing us all of this science and evidence, plus what we had dug up on our own. And we went to so many city council meetings, so many town hall meetings, and mailed letters, signed petitions, did whatever we could to bring them the science and research to prove this is not okay. We took our own medical records in, our own water tests in, and to say, stop this because you're poisoning people, it needs to stop. And they just laughed us off. They called us liars. They called us crazy to our face. And every time, like, the mayor went on TV drinking the water, the former mayor, and saying that, oh, the water's safe, it tastes great, it was a slap in the face to every citizen who was getting sick.
Mark Edwards, did you witness this government attitude of dismissiveness and even laughing at people like Melissa?
Yes, I did. And I heard their stories and I also verified it from other sources that this was occurring. So we at Virginia Tech, we were pretty upset to hear about that, especially given that we had already measured these hazardous waste levels of lead in one Flint home and a brave EPA employee had written a memo essentially saying Flint was breaking federal law. And so rather than address the legitimate science questions, they mounted a public relations campaign to discredit the residents, to discredit us. And I have never seen this level of arrogance and incompetence. It was mostly confined to a few key individuals, but other people are guilty of being far too trusting of those individuals and not listening to the people who were drinking this water.
Now, there's nothing confined about this contamination. How many people do you expect that it is affecting?
Well, in terms of the lead issue alone, the hazardous waste levels of lead we found in a few homes, the levels of lead were generally too high throughout the city. There's no way that Flint can be considered to have been meeting federal standards for lead and water safety. So in at least 25% of the homes in Flint, the lead in water was too safe. And of course, all the homes had problems in terms of distasteful, discolored water. And the amount of discoloration varied dramatically depending on whether you had an iron pipe in front of your house or not. So the harm wasn't spread equally throughout the city, but it was far too much of the population was exposed, and all of Flint, in the end, was a high-risk zone because we don't know where all the lead pipes are.
Melissa, what are the permanent impacts on your children, as far as you can tell?
What we're seeing already with our kids is lead lines in my middle child's bones. He is 12. He fell off of his bike, and he has two buckle fractures in his wrist just from falling over. So his bones are weaker. My oldest, he's got holes in the smooth sides of his teeth. So he's had to have two root canals and had to have fillings done. And the dentist believes it's because of the lead. And my youngest is still struggling. We can't get his white blood cell count above 4 when a year and a half ago, it was 10.4, I believe. So his immune system's compromised, and he's getting sick anytime somebody sneezes, basically. So it's been an ongoing struggle, and then they're now all struggling in school, memory, brain fog, because with a lot of our blood work, we're coming back with, we had lead, copper, aluminum, tin, and chromium in our systems. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know what else you know, we've been working with an environmental physician, so it's been helpful. But I'm terrified for my kids because they were doing great in school. They had a great path that they were on, and now they're slipping.
And some people listening to this would say, well, get out of town, Melissa. I mean, you know, leave.
We probably would if we could, except for the fact that we own our home. And we were told by a realtor that it's illegal to sell your home with a known copper and lead problem unless you fix it. And we just don't have the money to replace our service line, plus all our interior plumbing and our water heater yet again. We're on number three in 14 months. So the money that we put out in bottled water, plus $200 to $300 per month for bills, for the water bill, and all the medication, because the detox therapies are not covered by insurance, and neither is the environmental physician we're seeing. So we're just too tight, so we can't up and leave. And then again, this is home.
Mark Edwards, I've seen reports that say that this contamination and the impact of this contamination has been borne unfairly on the backs of poor and African-American individuals in the Flint community. Is that your assessment of this?
Yes, that's always the case, unfortunately, with lead and water exposure, because, for example, breastfeeding, which is less common amongst poor people, they would use infant formula, and this is the major exposure route to children. So we always see economic disparities in terms of the lead poisoning incidents, and certainly that was probably the case in Flint, because some people could afford to buy bottled water by filters from the earliest phases, and they were protected to at least some extent from the lead in water. And it was truly the poorest people who could not afford to buy bottled water for whatever reason, could not breastfeed because of conflicts with work, and couldn't buy filters. And it's those children that bore the greatest harm here.
Mark Edwards is a professor at Virginia Tech's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Mays, what do you think you'll be saying about this 10 years, 20 years from now?
Well, I'm hoping that things get changed like they're supposed to here. And I'm hoping that the city of Flint is a shining example of citizens standing up when they know something's wrong, getting the right answers, and continuing to fight no matter how hard and how difficult and how much they dismiss you. I want us to be a good example. And I want us to be an example of why cities and states should never cut corners when it comes to water treatment, and they should maintain and monitor the water system properly. So that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping 10 years from now, other crises will be averted because of what's happened here.
Melissa Mays is a resident of Flint, Michigan, a parent and founder of What Are You Fighting For?, an activist group that is focused on the contamination in Flint. Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. I don't know if we would call it a resolution, but the new year has been an opportunity for North Korea's Kim Jong-un to turn the page in his nuclear program. North Korea has claimed a successful test of the country's first hydrogen bomb. What does a North Korean thermonuclear weapon mean for the region? And how seriously should anyone take this New Year's nuclear resolution? Joining us is David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
How do American officials confirm something like this, a claim like this, beyond a ripple in the earth?
Well, there are a couple ways. First, the ripple right now, just the size of it, the seismic pattern that it left, would leave room for considerable skepticism that this was actually a hydrogen bomb test. And we can come back a little bit later to why that is. But the only way to tell for sure is through the atmospheric testing that takes place from a large group of sniffer planes that the United States keeps in Japan and runs up along the North Korean coast, hoping to trap some of the atmospheric particles that get sent out after a nuclear test. And that should give the definitive evidence, if you can get the right particles at the right time, and it depends a lot on the winds, about whether or not it was an H-bomb, a thermonuclear weapon, whether it was fueled by uranium or plutonium. But these tests don't always work.
A thermonuclear bomb, would that be technology that was available to the North Koreans through IQCON, who apparently supplied them with what became the weapon we know exists?
The bomb design that AQ Khan gave to the North Koreans and also to the Libyans, which is how the U.S. and others have seen copies of it, and presumably to the Iranians, was of an early Chinese test of a traditional weapon. The getting the plans for how one would put together a thermonuclear weapon wouldn't be that hard. Making the engineering work was a completely different story. It's quite complicated because a normal atomic weapon is a fission weapon, and to make a thermonuclear weapon, you then have to also start a separate fusion process. So it's basically a two-step bomb. And that's pretty complicated. It took the United States, which first detonated its first thermonuclear weapon in 1952, a long time to figure it out. The four other declared nuclear powers, Russia, China, Britain, France, have all succeeded at it. But we don't have any evidence, for example, that the Indians and the Pakistanis have. And we don't know about Israel, which may never have tested a weapon. So it would be pretty tricky, and there's reason to doubt whether the North Koreans are up to it.
How does the strategic symbolism of this for Kim Jong-un relate to the already strategic significance of having a fission bomb? What does he get out of this?
Only to a matter of degree, a reminder to the rest of the world that he's still out there, that while we were focused on Iran and the Iranian nuclear negotiations, that he was chugging ahead. He probably has a mixed view of the Iranian negotiations. On the one hand, the Iranians gave up for some period of time their ability to build a weapon. On the other hand, they had sanctions or are about to have sanctions against them lifted. Sanctions against North Korea aren't going away for a long time, if ever. But this is a reminder to the world and to Washington that the size of the North Korean arsenal has increased significantly, that their missile capabilities are improving. And it's only a matter of time before they figure out how to mount a nuclear weapon on top of one of those missiles.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What can anyone do about North Korea's aspirations to develop a hydrogen bomb? Little, apparently. The nation with the most leverage, its ally China, condemned this detonation announcement to little effect. China seems to be at a moment of considerable anxiety right now, seeing critics and enemies all around it. A crackdown on journalists inside the country and an accelerated program to hack into information systems around the world is part of a disturbing set of trends seen in Beijing. Adam Schiff is Democratic representative for California's 28th District and ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Schiff, welcome.
Great to be with you.
China has issued a statement in the wake of this announcement from Pyongyang that there's been a test of a nuclear device. It appears China is condemning them, but how would you assess their ability to restrain North Korea, if at all?
Their ability to restrain North Korea is limited, but frankly, it's more extensive than probably any other country. The North often depends on them for fuel, for outside commerce, but we don't know really how seriously China took the test in terms of being willing to retaliate with sanctions or by making North Korea pay an economic price.
Do you have doubts that the Chinese are serious in their criticism of North Korea, especially as it relates to the relationship with the United States, where there are constant talks about stability in the region, but China is often seen to say one thing and then do another in many strategic zones in the Pacific?
I think China is serious about its discontent with North Korea and its unhappiness about this apparent nuclear test. At the same time, though, China doesn't want to take action that could trigger a collapse of the regime, a flood of refugees into China, or probably worse from China's perspective, a collapse that means a consolidated Western-leaning Korea on its border. So while it is upset with North Korea, while it doesn't like the change in this young leader, Kim Jong-un, and I think one of Kim Jong-un's first actions was to execute his uncle, who was the one who had the strongest relationship with China. Still, there are bounds, boundaries to what China is willing to do.
Would you say that China's control of information right now, and this is something that bears directly on your responsibility in the U.S. Congress, is part of a kind of war on the West or war on the United States, if we're talking about cyber attacks, if we're talking about control of journalists and reporting in China? How would you assess that?
I think there are a couple of different motivations. There's the motivation to crack down on internal dissent, on journalists, on those that are exposing corruption within the regime or high-ranking officials. Unfortunately, China is becoming a huge prison for journalists, and this is an effort to really protect the party, to protect the regime against internal dissent, much less having to do with the United States. But the cyber war that is low level at this point, it's largely cyber theft by China, cyber foreign intelligence gathering by China. That is a very different motivation. That has a motivation to strengthen their economy at the expense of other world powers. But also it has the interest of using this new cyber tool to gain incredible amounts of information and intelligence, as we likely saw with the OPM hack.
Congressman Schiff, you're not an individual who loves to rattle sabers and engage in rhetorical flourishes on this subject. I'm wondering if you view this as a bipartisan issue, that there is a sense of worry that Republicans and Democrats share. Give me your sense of the worry from your point of view, and are there Republicans that share it?
It's a very bipartisan concern. You know, I have to say, you know, several years ago when the United States started talking about a pivot to Asia, it was often said in the context of we're drawing down in Iraq, we're drawing down our troops in Afghanistan, and now we're going to pivot to Asia. If I were China and I were hearing it in that context, I would think that the pivot was a military pivot. And so we may have provoked some of the fears that China has. I think this strikes members on both sides of the aisle as very concerning, very alarming. It is developing, frankly, a lot of friends for the United States in that part of the world. I was just in Vietnam and Myanmar a month or two ago. There was a real receptivity to a new kind of relationship with the United States, driven largely by fears over China.
Congressman Adam Schiff is a Democratic representative for California's 28th District and a ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Schiff, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
China's worries about North Korea and inability to do anything about it may relate to that pivot to Asia Congressman Schiff was just referring to. Might China have considered this innocuous-sounding bit of wonkery from President Obama a few years back actually a provocation?
After a decade in which we fought two wars that cost us dearly, in blood and treasure, the United States is turning our attention to the vast potential of the Asia-Pacific region.
Leave the two wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan and start one in the Pacific. That's certainly not what the president said back in 2011, but that interpretation may help explain the rhetoric and growing militarization of China as it confronts the West. Peter Navarro is the author of Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. He says, we've missed an opportunity in Asia, especially as China continues to grow economically and militarily.
We here in this country have basically been, I call it the grand distraction with other parts of the world, Afghanistan, Iraq. Meanwhile, over the last 15 years, there's been a dual process. China entered our markets in 2001 when we let them into the World Trade Organization. And over that 15-year period, there's been a steady offshoring of our factories and jobs to China, and that's given them essentially the economic engine that we once had to produce what is a startling array of the largest and most diverse missile arsenal in the world, the largest inventory of sea mines, the fastest growing rate of conventional submarines, and a world of cyber and space warfare that we don't even want to imagine. So they are flexing their muscles, its symbols, and it's very much action in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, even in the hills of India.
In this book, you mix a very broad sense of history with a notion of current events as a way of evaluating how concerned we should be about China. In the first chapter, you talk about something called the Thucydides trap and a security dilemma. What's that all about?
The Thucydides trap is basically a theory in international relations that says when an established power like the United States meets a rising power like China, the probability of conflict historically is about 75%. And the Thucydides trap gets its name from the original superpower conflict between the established power of Sparta and the rising upstart of Athens. And what I'm trying to do is look at a chessboard here, which I see this country basically ignoring, but which is basically leading us down the road to that Thucydides trap if we do not change course right now. And this is why the presidential election, I believe, is so important. We need, John, an election that's finally about foreign policy, because we've neglected that now for about four cycles.
Now, the Obama administration would say that, in fact, there's a pivot to the Pacific that is making China much more relevant, despite the distractions that are certainly very frustrating in the Middle East to the administration. And also, there's a sense that the administration believes, and it's not just the Obama administration, the Bush administration would be included in this as well, that engagement with China is the way to avoid the conflict that the Thucydides trap would suggest we're headed for.
Sure. Let's talk pivot and then engagement. The idea of the pivot is to take 60% of our ships, which are now deployed elsewhere in the world, and move them over to Asia. So we got a 60-40 split. But at the height of the Reagan administration, we had 600 ships. We're down, moving to towards 200 now. So by 2020, with the pivot, we'll have 60% of our ships there, but actually a smaller number of ships. So whatever the Obama administration says about that, the pivot's not working, and it's not a Democratic problem. It's a bipartisan problem because of the budget sequestration. Now, the economic engagement argument, if you go back to 1914 and you just substitute a couple of different countries' names, it's the same rhetoric. Kaiser Germany and Great Britain would never have a war because of too much trade between them. And then we had that war. And I'm worried both about a Sarajevo moment in the East China Sea, and a miscalculation by the Chinese about our will over something, for example, like Taiwan.
The Chinese media talks incessantly about the U.S. strategy to contain China, that as it emerges from this humiliation, that the West, particularly the United States, will want to contain China's growth. First of all, is that true? And is China already past the point where the U.S. has any capability of containing them?
Containment is kind of like a four-letter word. It's kind of a cold warrior kind of word. So you have to be really careful about it. But one of the things in the Crouching Tiger book is I go over the geography, the tyranny of geography that China faces. They have the first island chain, which goes from Japan through Taiwan to the Philippines, and then the second island chain, which goes from Japan out to Guam and over to New Guinea. And the tyranny of geography for China as a naval force is basically that it's very difficult to get their warships out of the choke points of Asia should push come to shove and there be conflict. But there's no question right now that containment as a concept, it's who, John, it's who controls the waters of the first and second island chain. China wants us out.
Peter Navarro, thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
Peter Navarro is professor of economics and public policy at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. Okay, so Kim Jong-un wants his new year to be about H-bombs. Personally, I think a dieting resolution might be a better idea for the dear leader. For the rest of us, the key to resolutions apparently has as much to do with the support people get in doing them, which means you've got to ignore all of those late-night cynics and resolution hater guys like John Oliver.
But let's be honest, we're a few days into the new year now, and if you haven't broken your resolutions yet, statistically, you are about to.
I mean, everyone's resolution is going to fail, isn't it? I mean, even the start of the new year is commemorated with somebody dropping the ball.
This year, I'm going to lose 10 pounds, or by a scale that is off by 10 pounds.
Forget those dudes, folks. Have some faith and self-esteem, people.
This is Tom in Austin, Texas. On January 4th, 2006, I made the anti-New Year's resolution to stop smoking. By removing it from the new year, I gave myself permission to call it my own. I haven't had a cigarette since.
Okay, as always, we're here to help, and we're not alone. This week, the podcast Only Human from WNYC Studios is kicking off a New Year's resolution project with Duke University behavioral psychologist and best-selling author Dan Ariely. Takeaway listeners are invited to participate. It's called Stick to It, a smartphone-based research partnership with Dr. Ariely, one of the foremost researchers on procrastination and willpower and why people abandon their goals so easily. Dr. Dan is in the house. Welcome back and Happy New Year.
A very Happy New Year.
And you're the resolution expert here as far as behavioral economics is concerned. Tell me what you hope to achieve in this initiative with Only Human.
We teamed up with Only Human with the idea to try and help people further with New Year resolutions. So New Year resolutions are kind of nice things. Everybody, when they makes them, hope to actually achieve them. The problem is that then we run into regular life. So you say to yourself, oh, I'm going to eat better, but then you run into the same restaurant and the same temptation and so on. You say, I'll save money, but you get the same temptation to buy things. And we fail time after time. And what we realize in social science in general is that the environment matters. And people can have good intentions, but without the supporting environment for that, it will be hard. Now, we can't go into people's homes and change the refrigerators and all kinds of things like that in terms of restructuring their environment, but we can give people a different environment on their phone. So we're creating a few different versions of an app that is supposed to kind of help people along the journey of getting their good intentions in terms of New Year resolution and help them along the way by getting them to be a bit more likely to stick to it.
So my wife, she wants to eat better, and I'm the cook in the household. She'll say to me, you know, tell me when I'm eating badly. And I sometimes say, you know, that's sort of annoying. You know, deal with it yourself kind of thing, because I guess I'm such a jerk. But this is really crucial for her success, is to have me be kind of the app for her, reminding her and supporting her in what she does. I mean, I have to cook for five kids, so you can't always have, you know, organic kale for five kids. But still, I need to be more supportive for precisely this reason.
You should be more supportive. And you could say it's her duty. But the fact is that the moment you serve her a plate, kind of the battle has been lost, right? It's very hard not to finish what you're being served. And not only that, doing things like calorie counting, if you're in charge of your own activity, it's just really exhausting. As you go through the day and you have to make lots of decisions, you get mentally tired. So if I ask you to count calories, what will happen is that you'll really get tired of this. By the way, the same thing happens with budgeting. If you have a very strict budget and you keep on in your mind all the time how much money you're spending, it's a very unpleasant feeling and the whole joy of life goes down. So imagine two scenarios. Imagine one scenario in which you just give your wife half a plate of food, or, you know, 75% of her food, or another one in which you give her a full plate and you say, why don't you eat less, right? The first one is just much more helpful. She doesn't have to make the decision. She will enjoy the food more and actually eat less.
What's the tone of your app? Is it going to be helpful and encouraging? Is it going to be a little frightening? Is it going to be beeps and you know, I'm trying to imagine what you're going to come up with here because you're an MIT guy.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, the apps work on general on people, but they don't necessarily work on everybody. So it's not as if we can guarantee that will work on everybody, these kind of solutions. It's much more about fitting in with people's lifestyle, figuring out how to do things on time, thinking about kind of a process, not about just a specific reminder. But we also have different versions, and we're going to try and see at the end of the day which version works better.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Let me have a go at this that came in from one of our listeners. A fellow in Austin, Texas said he made an anti-New Year's Eve resolution to stop smoking, and he described that by removing it from the new year, he gave himself permission to call it his own, and he says he's had success. What's he talking about, an anti-resolution?
Yeah, so this is his term. Usually when we think about an anti-resolution, we think about something that will happen if you break that, right? So you could say a resolution is usually about a good thing, right? So you could say, oh, I'll stop smoking. But you can make another resolution that says, if I continue smoking, I'll give money to some charity I really hate, right, the KKK or something like that. and basically you can commit to that. There's actually a beautiful website called stick.com that allows you to do it. So you can partner with somebody and say, you know what, I don't want to drink any soft drinks. If you see me drinking any soft drink, for every drink I have, I'll put $5 into the KKK fund. And every time they see you, they report it. And then the idea is that the shame and the embarrassment of giving money to a charity you hate so much, plus it can go public, right? You can post it on Facebook. However, despite what this listener is saying, in general, we find that the new year is a good time to make a resolution. And here's the idea. We live continuously over time, right? We're kind of the same people that we were. And if you ask yourself, am I a good John? Am I a bad John? You're just kind of a combination of what you've been before. But the new year allows you to have a breaking point and to kind of to start fresh. And you can say to yourself, okay, now I'll be good. And what happened is that as long as you're good, you can think of yourself as better. So let's just take something like dieting. Imagine that on average, you're good in terms of your eating habits 80% of the time. If you start tomorrow and you say, I'm good 80% of the time, if I'll be really good today, it will be 80.001. If I'll not be good, it will be 79.996, right? It's not a big deal. You're not changing the statistics. But if you have a new year, there's a chance to have basically a kind of a strike, right? There's a chance to basically say, you know what? I've been good every day since the beginning of the year. I'm the kind of a person who does that. Now, sadly, at some point you fail and so on, but it's actually a good time to say, I'm going to be a different person and I'm going to think of myself as the new person just from that point and kind of reset the statistics. If you start from scratch, it can make a big difference.
Dan Ariely, if we somehow get a boost of contributions to the KKK as a result of this segment, can I talk to you about that?
I will make an anti-donation if anybody donates to that cause.
Thank you. I mean, very interesting, but if that was the consequence here, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that. Dan Ariely, Duke University behavioral psychologist and best-selling author, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can go to thetakeaway.org and download apps that Ariely and his team at the Duke Center for Advanced Hindsight are anticipating will encourage people to exercise more. And finally, he wanted music to leave the classical world of Isaac Newton and enter the new world of Einstein. Frenchman Pierre Boulez helped to define modern music as a composer, and then he spent decades as a conductor, reconciling music's old and new repertoire for audiences all around the world. He died on Tuesday at his home in Germany at the age of 90. Boulez, fiery, brilliant, cerebral, for most of his life a legendary musical bridge from the 1800s to the 21st century. His 1955 composition, Le Marteau sans Maître, The Hammer Without a Master. Surely, we've lost a master. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.